when the Torah says the mitzvah of marriage, it says it in a very general way. Ki yikach ish isha, when a man will take a woman. And it doesn't specify how that taking is supposed to take place. What affects a marriage? And for all we know, the taking could be clubbing her over the head with a club and dragging her by the hair into your cave. So how do we know how you affect a marriage? So the rabbi said, we learn from this week's Sedra. How so? And not from the part of the Sedra where Yitzchak married Rivka, from the other part of the Sedra. From the part of the Sedra where Avraham buys a burial place for Sarah. There the Torah says, Kesef hasode kach mimeni. The money of the field that Avraham purchased in which to bury Sarah, take the money from me. Now one of the 13 principles through which the Torah is learned, that were divinely given. These are God's instructions of how to learn things from the Torah. One of those 13 principles is called Gzeirah Shavah. Gzeirah Shavah is where the Torah meant two similar words to be learned one from the other, to learn the laws of one from the context of the other. Therefore, when the Torah said, Ki yikach ish isha, a man will take a woman, and it doesn't specify how that taking should be done. We learn from here, Kesef hasadeh, kach mimeni, the same word, kach, and there it's going on money that a woman is acquired by giving her something of value, money, or something worth money. And the custom is to give her a ring, but really give her anything. Under the chuppah, you can give her a bottle of Coke. And say Ariad Mekudeshesli, as long as it's worth a Shavapruta, it's worth a minimum of about 5 agurot, that affects the marriage. And that's how we know that one of the methods of affecting a marriage is by the man giving the woman, in front of witnesses, something of value. Now, those that like to detract and denigrate the Torah use this as an example of how the Torah denigrates women, because we are equating marrying a woman with buying a field. You buy a field for money, a very mercenary real estate deal, and the same thing, you get married, so you basically buy a woman. Same kind of mercenary thing. Here you buy a field, here you buy a woman. And it seems to reduce a woman to the status of a field, a piece of dirt. So how do we understand that? How do we understand that kedushin, marriage, is learned from buying the field of Ephraim? This is what the detractors of Torah attack us with. I'm going to show you that not only is this not a question, but what we learn and where we learn it from is probably the only place in the Torah that could really reveal the true essence of what marriage is. But what I'm going to tell you is a little involved and complicated, so you're going to have to really pay attention. And we're going to go from one subject to another, and eventually, I promise you, I know how it's going to end up. We're going to put them all together, and it will answer our question. Even though the subjects that seemingly we're going to discuss have absolutely nothing to do with what we started with. But I promise you, by the end, it will all fit together. So let's start. Start with a totally unrelated question. When we answer that, we're going to have to get another unrelated question, and then we'll come back to what we started with. The Ibn Ezra, as well as other commentaries, ask the following question. Why did the Torah go to such great length, such verbosity and detail to tell us how Avraham Avinu bought the burial plot Moras HaMachpelah? What? The Torah usually does not go into such great detail about things that it could be very concise. It could have told Ashot it in one sentence. And Avram bought the cave of Machpelah from Ephron Hachiti for 400 shekel. Period. Why all the back and forth? What he said, and what he answered, and what he said. Who cares? Get to the bottom line. The Torah does not record many things with such detail and with such length. Why here did the Torah feel it necessary to enlarge upon this? Says the Ibn Ezra, because the Torah wanted to impress us with how much effort and how much expense Avraham Avinu went to bury Sarah in Eretz Yisrael. So we can learn from that Eretz Yisrael is valuable, not only to the living, but even to the dead. Not only is it a special merit to live in Eretz Yisrael, there's even a special merit to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Because you see that Avraham Avinu went to such bother, such effort, and such expense to make sure that Sarah was buried in Eretz Yisrael. That's what the Ibn Ezra says. The Ramban questions this. He says, I don't question what the Ibn Ezra says as being a fact. There is tremendous merit to live and even be buried in Eretz Yisrael. But you can't learn that from this parsha. Because where was Avraham Avinu supposed to bury Eretz Yisrael? In Borough Park? She died in Hebron. She died in Eretz Yisrael. You bury people where they die. You don't ship their bodies someplace else. It would have been more bother and more expense to ship her somewhere else. So it's natural to bury people where they die.
What about
yourself? But Lamaisha, like the norm is to bury where you die, not to take somewhere else. Right? That's why it was difficult for Yosef. That's why it was a special thing for Yaakov. So what do we expect Avraham to do? He should have buried her someplace else. But because he went to the effort and expense of burying her in Eretz Yisrael, we see how valuable Eretz Yisrael is. Maybe not. Maybe had she died in Borough Park, he would have buried her in Borough Park. But she happened to die in Eretz Yisrael, so he buried her in Eretz Yisrael. Where do we see from this parsha that there's anything special about being buried in Eretz Yisrael? It's true, but you don't see it from here. So the Ramban gives another answer, which we're not going to go into, of why the Torah goes to such length to describe the acquisition of this burial plot. But he disagrees with the Ibn Ezra, and we're left with a question on the Ibn Ezra. Very good question. What did the Ibn Ezra mean? That we learn from here how valuable Eretz Yisrael is to the dead and to the living, because Avraham went to effort and expense to bury Sarah in Eretz Yisrael. The question of the Ramban is pretty much a very serious question. In order to understand this, we have to go to a different subject. Also, seemingly having nothing to do with the topic that we're discussing, but you'll see that it'll tie in. The Ramban, in this week's Sedra, in last week's Sedra, in Parshas Achrimos, in quite a few places in Chumash, the Ramban expounds the following idea. It's a famous idea of the Ramban, which is taken up by many others. The Ramban says that mitzvot are basically intrinsically meant for Eretz Yisrael. They don't apply intrinsically outside the land of Israel. Even though God commanded us to keep a good portion of the commandments even in Chutz La'aretz, even outside of Eretz Yisrael, basically the mitzvahs that are not tied to agriculture, but that's a king's command. He wants us to do it. But the intrinsic value of the mitzvah, the intrinsic effect of the mitzvah, is only in Eretz Yisrael. The Torah was meant for Eretz Yisrael exclusively. When we went into Galus, for people who don't live in Eretz Yisrael, also have to keep, by divine command, many of the mitzvahs. But the intrinsic benefit of the mitzvah, the intrinsic place where the mitzvah has an effect, is only Eretz Yisrael. And that's why he says, God is called Elokei Haaretz. He's the God of the land. Because basically God's relationship to the world and to the Jewish people filters through the land of Israel. And therefore, the relationship that God has with lands outside of Eretz Israel and people who live there is relative to Eretz Israel like the person doesn't have a God. The intensity of the relationship here compared to the relationship there is like over there, it's like it doesn't exist. So a person who lives in the Chutz La'aretz like he doesn't have a God, relatively speaking. And therefore the Ramban says that our forefathers, before the Torah was commanded, who kept the Torah voluntarily because of the intrinsic value of keeping mitzvahs, only kept it basically in Eretz Israel. But when they were outside of Eretz Israel, they didn't necessarily keep it, because the full effect, the intrinsic effect of mitzvahs, for the most part, doesn't exist outside of Eretz Israel. So there, if they saw a reason not to do the mitzvah for a benefit, they didn't do it. They weren't commanded. They were only keeping it because of the intrinsic benefit. And that intrinsic benefit was basically in Eretz Israel. So if they were outside of Eretz Israel, they could not keep the Torah in that time or before it was commanded. And therefore, that explains how Yaakov Avinu could marry two sisters because he wasn't in Eretz Israel. And then concludes the Ramban, that also explains why Rachel Imenu had to die before they got back to Eretz Israel, so he shouldn't be married to two sisters in Eretz Israel. And therefore Rachel Imenu died before they returned to Eretz Israel. All of this is the words of the Ramban. Now somebody should ask me a very simple question on this Ramban. Very simple. Okay, let me hint to you the answer. Who is buried in Kevar? Excellent. Okay, now let me make everybody else aware of what you understand as simple. Who is buried in Kevar Rachel? Good. Just like who's buried in Grant's tomb. Okay? Right. Rachel is buried in Kevar Rachel. Where did Rachel Imenu die? Where she's buried? In Beit Lechem. Right? On the road to Hebron. Where is Beit Lechem? How many of you have ever been to Kevar Rachel? Did you need a visa to leave the country? So, Kevar Rachel is in Beit Lechem. Beit Lechem, what?
Don't push it now.
Okay.
It's almost
the shallow. But Beit Lechem is basically, from our standpoint, in Eretz Israel. Okay? From other people's standpoint, Eretz Israel is not in Eretz Israel. It doesn't make a difference. But Beit Lechem is in Eretz Israel. Rachel died where she was buried. That means she died in Beit Lechem. So what does that mean? That Rachel died before they got back to Eretz Israel, so Yaakov should not be married to two sisters in Eretz Israel. It's not true. Rachel died in Eretz Israel. What's Ramban talking about? He knows very well where Rachel Imenu died. How could he say she died before they got back to Eretz Israel? There's probably a very simple answer to this, which I'll tell you, even though it'll take a little thunder out of what the Chasam Sofer says. The basic prohibition of being married to two sisters is not the marriage itself. It's the fact of having relations through marriage with two sisters. And therefore, Rachel Imenu died in Eretz Israel, but before Yaakov had a chance to have relations with her in Eretz Israel. That's what he means. I think, simple. But the Chasam Sofer says a much more interesting answer. He explains what the Ramban means, that Rachel Imenu died before they got back to Eretz Israel. And he says the following. The land that we are now sitting on has many names to it and many levels of holiness. When the world was created, before anyone lived here, this land was created to be special. It was called Eretz HaNivchar, the chosen land. It was called Eretz HaKodesh, the holy land. Eretz HaSkula, the special quality land, Eretz Hachayim, and a host of other names. And that is irrespective if anybody lives here or not. The land itself has various special qualities. Originally, it was occupied by the Canaan. So it was called Eretz Canaan. It still had a lot of holiness and a lot of special qualities, but it didn't yet have many aspects of holiness that it would get in the future. What gave it that holiness? The fact that it became the property of the Jewish people. Even though potentially this land was already promised to Avraham Avinu, but it didn't become actually the possession of the Jewish people till we conquered it and settled it after Yahushua. And then when we were sent into exile, according to many, that was abrogated. We lost our connection to the land, and it was renewed when the Persians gave us the right to come back and acquire the land again. In those times that the land belongs to us, and after we acquired it from the Persians, who had gotten it from the Babylonians who conquered it, it remains ours forever. Because the act of acquisition that we made in the time of Persia was eternal. The conquering that we did was only as long as we were conquerors. As soon as we were conquered, that conquering was abrogated. But the second time around, it wasn't conquering. It was an act of acquisition, and that remains forever, because you can't steal land. And even though they conquered us and they took the land away from us, it's still our land.
What about the first time?
First time, we didn't acquire it with an act of acquisition. We acquired it through conquering. And conquering is abrogated by other conquering. But acquisition is not abrogated. In any case, so until the land became the possession of the Jewish people, it wasn't Eretz Yisrael. It was Eretz Canaan. Eretz Yisrael, the Rambam explains, is Eretz Shel Yisrael. It's the land that belongs to the Jewish people, that we possess. And in order to possess it, we had to make an act of acquisition some way to gain possession. Just like anybody, you want to buy something, you want to acquire something, you have to make some kind of act of acquisition. Until that happened, the land lacked its full holiness. That means that if you planted something in the land before the Jewish people took possession and divided it up, there was no halachas of truma, meiser, or many of the other laws of agriculture. They didn't exist. They only exist in Eretz Yisrael. And Eretz Yisrael is only this land that is acquired by the Jewish people in a certain way, by the majority of the Jewish people, with the king, with the Sanhedrin, whatever it may be. There are ways of making that acquisition. And that's called Eretz Yisrael. It's interesting, therefore, that the chosen land can be, even if it's not Eretz Yisrael, even during the times that it didn't belong to the Jewish people, it had certain holiness. There was a mitzvah to live here, because living here brought a person tremendous merit. But if you planted things here, it didn't have the holiness of creating truma, meiser, and all the other halachas of agriculture. It's interesting also, so you can have the holiness of the chosen land without the holiness of Eretz Yisrael in a time when it's not possessed by the Jewish people. There's another interesting thing. You can have the holiness of Eretz Yisrael without having the chosen land. But not that it becomes the chosen land. Not that it becomes a place where there's a mitzvah to live. But if you plant things there, they are reliable to Truma and Meiser. That means that if the Jewish people go and we conquer Borough Park and it becomes our possession, okay, totally, and we've already conquered all of Eretz Yisrael, that's a condition, then if you plant something in Borough Park, you have to take Trumas and Meisers. So it makes Borough Park Eretz Yisrael. It becomes Eretz Shel Yisrael. But it doesn't become the chosen land. It's Eretz Yisrael just insofar that it belongs to the Jewish people. And the laws of Truman Meister depend on that. But it's not a place where there's a mitzvah to live. It's not the chosen land. It's not the place where you can build a Beis HaMikdash or where prophecy can take effect. That's only in the chosen land. So when the chosen land is not possessed by Jews, it has certain holiness. That holiness can only be here. When the holy land is possessed by Jews, then its holiness is, what's it called, raised, is elevated to a different level. And then it has also the holiness of agriculture. The agricultural mitzvahs also apply. And therefore, in the time of Yaakov Avinu, what could be called, which portion of this land could be called Eretz Yisrael? Most of it not, because it wasn't possessed by Jews. It was possessed at the time by the nations of Canaan. So it was called Eretz Canaan. It was not Eretz Yisrael. It was Eretz HaKodesh, but it was Eretz Canaan. Which part had the full holiness because it belonged to a Jew?
Hebron.
Hebron? Yeah, okay. But that was later. That was Yaakov did that. But when Yaakov went to what's it called, came back from Laban, basically it was only... Yeah, okay. Okay, whatever. But in any case, but what existed before that was Hebron. Because he bought it. And Avram also had the designation of Yisrael. So the land that belonged to Avram had the designation of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, it could be that the Avos only kept the Torah in that portion of Eretz Yisrael that had its full holiness. The portion where not only it was Eretz HaKodesh, but it was also Eretz Yisrael. But that was only Hebron. That's what the Ramban means. Rachel Imenu died before they came back to Eretz Yisrael. Not Eretz Canaan. Sure, she died in the Holy Land. She died in what later would be Eretz Yisrael. But when she died in Beis Lechem, it didn't have the designation Eretz Yisrael. It only had the designation Eretz Canaan. But she was just outside getting to Hebron. And that was Eretz Yisrael. So she died before they got back to Eretz Yisrael. So says the Chasam Sofer. That's what the Ramban means. There was nothing that was designated Eretz Yisrael at the time except Hebron. So she died before they got back to Hebron.
She died in
Kehilah? Right, which is right outside. She really died right now. She died in Beis Lechem. Beis Lechem. So that's, now we have enough information to put this all together and see what we learn from Avram's buying Moris HaMachpelah. The effort and the expense, what that means. But first we need one more part to this introduction, to the answer. And that is, what was the give and take between Avram and the people of Chais and then Ephraim in buying this burial plot? There's a lot of things that don't seem to be clear. And included in that, there's a lot of things that on the surface seem very difficult, because both Avram and Ephraim are, what's it called, always saying and prefacing their words with, listen to me, hear what I'm saying. What a death. Why do they have to preface what they said? Hear me. Shmo'eini Adoni. Hear me. Hear me. Why don't you say what they have said? So let me tell you, what I'm telling you now is the conglomeration of a few different commentaries. The Ramban, the Sforno, the Shamshon Fol Hirsch, each one has a little different perspective. I'm putting them all together with a little bit of enhancement of my own, and it makes the Parsha very well understood. Avram comes, his wife just died, he wants to bury her. In those days, as well as could be even today, there are two kinds of burial plots. Every city had private burial plots that were family plots, which were owned by the family. They were zoned to be burial plots, and they were owned, the land was owned by the family, and the burial took place in perpetuity, generation after generation. People buried there. The grandparents and the parents and the children and the grandchildren, generation after generation, were buried in those private burial grounds, family owned. Those were called family plots. But then you needed burial plots for people, and those were basically for the citizens of that city. People who lived there, in those days, people didn't travel around like they do today. They lived in a place, and their children lived there, and their grandchildren lived there, and they lived there for hundreds of years. And therefore, the people who were buried in their land, and generation after generation. But the fact of the matter was that there were people who come to visit the city, come on business, travelers passing through, and sometimes a person died suddenly in a city that wasn't his city, far away from home. What do you do with it? In those days, they couldn't normally ship a body back somewhere else. That was something unusual. Yaakov, Yosef, was something very unusual. Under normal circumstances, you buried the person where he died, even if he lived far away. Just in recent history, before World War I, the early 1900s, Reb Lazer Gordon, he was the founder of the yeshiva in Telge, Lithuania. And he was on a fundraising trip in London. And he died there, in the middle of the trip. Some say he died because he wasn't successful in raising the money. Died of a broken heart there. He had a lot of trouble that they gave him in London. They didn't ship his body back to Lithuania. It was almost impossible. They buried him in London. His family wasn't there by the funeral. He was hundreds of miles away from home, but that's where they buried him. He's buried in the outskirts of London. He was there. I was there by his grave a few years ago with my son, somewhere it's about 20-25 minutes outside of Golders Green, where the cemetery is. In any case, so that's what they did. So they had cemeteries where people who didn't live in the city could have the right of burial, but they didn't own the land. It wasn't their land, right? If the body was exhumed, the family couldn't come and claim that land. It was just the right of burial for that person. Like T.S. Mason, the land goes back to the owners of that city. So they had what was called Achuzas Kever. Achuzas Kever were the family plots that were owned by the families and kept in perpetuity. And then they had what do they call it? Potter's Field? What's it called? What do they call it in the Old West? What's it called? Where they buried people, just beggars or whatever, who didn't own anything. And they buried them in the public burial place where they had the right to be buried, but they didn't own the land. Okay. So Avram comes to the people of Ches and he says, you probably consider me a ger, a stranger here. I'm not a citizen. I'm a stranger amongst you. And therefore, you would like to bury my wife in a plot that belongs to you. In other words, communal burial plot. Well, you'll give me the right to bury my wife. And normally charge me for those rights. But I'm telling you that I'm a Tosha. I'm a citizen here. Because this land is going to be mine and my children's forever. So I'm not burying my wife in your grave that you're going to sell me or give me. I want a burial plot here like any citizen, because I'm going to be burying my dead here in perpetuity, because this is my land. I'm a citizen. Ger Zitoshav Anokhi Mochem. Tnuli Achuzas Keber. I don't want a mere right of burial. I want an Achuzas Keber. I want a burial plot that will belong to my family in perpetuity. The people of Ches ignore what Avraham say, and they say, oh, you're a great leader amongst us. No one will hold back his grave from you to give it to you to bury your dead. Meaning, it's going to remain his grave, that we respect you tremendously, and we're going to give you it for free, but it's whoever gives it to you, it's his grave. It's his land. You have rights of burial, nothing more. And besides that, they hinted to the fact, nobody's going to sell you a burial plot. That is sacrilegious. You don't sell family plots. That's like selling your mother. That's very mercenary. It's not an accepted thing for people to make money on selling a burial plot. Very sacrilegious. Very not honorable. Avraham says, no problem. I know somebody who lives in your city that would sell his mother. He'd do anything for money. His name is Ephraim.
How do you know?
What? Do you know? The word gets around. Ephraim, you want something? Money? No object. There's no problem. For money, Ephraim will do anything. And he has a nice burial plot that I'm interested in. So you get me together with Ephraim, I'll work out the details. Now what Ephraim had to do is the following. He knew that Ephraim would sell him the burial plot. But he knew that Ephraim was concerned that he not look like some kind of mercenary heel selling a burial plot. So Avraham had to find some way of enabling Ephraim to sell the plot and not to look like he sold it. To look like he gave it away magnanimously and didn't make any money on it. So Avraham addresses Ephraim and he says to him the following, Shmo'eni Adoni, listen carefully. Because I can't say out what I mean, because we have to speak in hints, because what we're trying to do is not something nice, that you should sell me a burial plot. So if you listen carefully, I'm giving you the way to get your money, sell the plot, and to look like a big chocolate. Now listen what Avraham says. He says to him, I want you to give me that burial plot, and I will give you in exchange money. What does that mean? Avraham is saying to Ephraim, I don't want you to sell me the burial plot. Chas v'shalom, I know that you're a respectable person. You'd never sell a burial plot. But I'm in need. And giving it to me as a favor is not a mercenary thing. You could give me the burial plot. So if you'll be as kind to give it to me and be such a magnanimous person, who helped me in my plight, in my tzara, then I will be a magnanimous person and give you a present of money. No sale. It's not, I'm giving you money to buy the plot. You're giving me the plot for free, and I promise you a present of money in my gratitude for giving me the plot for free. That's what Avraham hints there. Ephraim doesn't like the idea. Why? Because yes, it enables him to give up the plot, to get money, and not look like he sold it. But there's one problem.
How much?
He can't determine the price. Because if he says to Avraham, hey, what kind of present is that? You should give me a bigger present. Then it's obvious that this is compensation for the plot. It's not a present. You don't go to people and say, how come you didn't give me a bigger present? So Ephraim didn't like that. He needs something that will make it look like he's giving him the plot, he's getting money, and he can determine how much money. So Ephraim says to Avraham, you listen to me. I'll give you a hint how you could get me to give you the plot. You'll give me money. I'll determine the price. It'll look like I gave it to you. Looks like you're doing something but not buying the plot, and everybody will be happy. Now listen carefully. He says, I'm willing to give you the cave and the field. Please take it as a present. Avram says, what field? I'm only negotiating for a burial pain. Who mentioned the field? The hint was the following. The cave, the Torah says, was at the end of the field. That means that access to the cave, you had to go through the field. Ephraim was hinting to the fact that unless you have a helicopter, Avram, you're not going to get to your cave if you don't buy the field. Because I will not give you access to your cave through my field. So if you want the cave for free, I would never think of selling a burial cave. Please take it for free. But you're going to have to buy the field. And the field is not consecrated land. It's a field. You want the cave? Buy the field. Avram catches on, says, great idea. You're going to give me the cave, and I'm going to buy the field so I'll have access to the cave. And that way you'll get your money. So how much do you want? Kesef ha'shaveh kach mimeni. I'm prepared to give you the money for what? The field. So we're doing a business deal on the field. The cave is for free. How much money do you want for the field? Ephraim says, what's a few million dollars between friends? So he overcharged him for the field. Avram was willing to spend that exorbitant fee so he could get access to the cave, which Ephraim gave him for free. And everybody looks great. Ephraim gets his money. He looks like a magnanimous guy who gave the cave for free, sold him a field, no problem. And Avram went to tremendous effort and tremendous expense to do that. Now, let's see the Ibn Ezra. Had Avram Avinu wanted to save a lot of money and a lot of effort, he could have agreed in the beginning to bury Sarah for free in their land. Not to get title to the land, not to own the land, but to have the right to bury her in their cemetery. Why didn't he want that? Why did he want the land to belong to him? That's what Ibn Ezra says. He went to effort and expense to bury her in Eretz Yisrael, not in Eretz Canaan. Because if he didn't buy the land, it wouldn't have been Eretz Yisrael. It would have remained Eretz Canaan. And from here you see the tremendous value of Eretz Yisrael, the land with the full holiness of belonging to a Jew, to the dead and to the living. That's what the Ibn Ezra says. True, Avram had to bury her in that geographic place, but that geographic place would have remained Eretz Canaan had he not bought it. And that's why it says after he bought it, by Yochum Stephron, the field, it was elevated. What it was elevated? Because it was owned by Avram, it was elevated to a new stature. Now it was Eretz Yisrael. Before he bought it, it was Eretz Canaan with a certain amount of holiness. Now it was Eretz Yisrael with a more full holiness. And that's what Avram wanted. He wanted Sarah Imenu to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, not in Eretz Canaan. So he went to all that bother and all that expense, did not agree to bury her in their land, but it had to be his land. So it should be Eretz Yisrael and not Eretz Canaan. That is, in my estimation, what the Ibn Ezra means. Now, yeah.
Did he know that Adam and Chava were buried there, or he brought Adam and Chava there?
It's not clear.
Maybe they wanted Ephraim.
It's not clear. It's not clear. Ephraim for sure didn't know.
It wasn't one of Ephraim's
though. No. It wasn't. I don't think it was known. It just happened to be in the end that that's the case that it was. I don't think they knew that at the time. In any case, so that's the Ibn Ezra. Now, let's go back to the question that we started with. We learn marriage from Avram's buying the field of Ephraim. Just like he bought the field for money, you acquire a woman with money. According to everything we've said, why did Avram buy that field? Because he wanted some real estate in Hebron? He wasn't interested in buying the field. He wasn't interested in buying anything. He wanted to bury his wife in Eretz Yisrael. But in order for it to be Eretz Yisrael, it had to own it. So when he bought it, did he buy it for mercenary purposes, or did he buy it so it should be elevated to the status of Eretz Yisrael by bonding with the soul of the Jewish people who Avraham Avinu represented? For the second reason. He didn't buy it because he wanted a piece of land. He didn't buy it for a real estate deal. He bought it for one reason only. If I don't buy it, my wife will not be buried in Eretz Yisrael. She'll be buried in Eretz Canaan. So I'm buying this to elevate the land to the level of Eretz Yisrael. How did he elevate? How does that become elevated? Because it belongs to a Jew. That means the soul of the Jew bonds with the land and raises it to a higher level. And then, when he buries Sarah in that land, the land raises her soul to a higher level, her body to a higher level. It's a symbiotic relationship. The Jewish people elevate and sanctify the land, and the land then has the power to elevate and sanctify them, both the living and the dead. Works both ways. We elevate the land, and the land in turn then elevates us more. And it goes back and forth. The more holy the Jewish people, the more holy the land. The more holy the land, the more effect it has on the Jewish people. And it goes back and forth and back and forth in an endless cycle. So it comes out that this acquisition of this field had nothing to do with a mercenary real estate deal. It was a case of someone giving money to bond his soul with the land so it could affect a uplifting of the land, and the land then become bonded to the soul of the Jewish people and uplifted the Jewish people. Isn't that what marriage is? Two people, through something of value, bonding their souls together, where each one elevates the other one and perfects the other one. That's the ideal of what marriage is. And that's exactly what happened over here. It was not a mercenary deal. It was a totally different idea. It was a bonding of the soul of the Jewish people with the soul of the land, and each one symbiotically benefiting the other. That's exactly what marriage is. So if you understand what was going on here, you don't have any questions.
You do have a question.
What?
You do have a question.
Yeah, okay, 1 second. Yeah.
But this is after he was married and he took her. He didn't give her...
No. Here we just learn that the same way that you acquired, that Avram acquired this field, and the word Torah said the word kach, take, when the Torah says take a wife, it means take in the same manner, by giving money. That's all we're learning from here. The manner of marriage. Not that Avram married her like that, that we don't know. But we know that he bought the field with money, and since the Torah used the same designation of kach as it did by taking a wife, that's the connection. Yeah.
It sounds like, well, this is great, but it sounds like the conquest before was in a lower level, and it really had no permanent effect.
It didn't.
So why did the Amisal keep all the business after the conquest?
Yeah, yeah.
They were valid?
Up until, 100%.
What?
Up until they were conquered. It had an effect, a full effect, as long as we were here. As soon as we were conquered, our conquering was negated.
How you said that before? Why is that?
Because there are two kinds of acquisitions. One is where somebody wants to give up his ownership and he's willing to sell something. Okay? So then I sell it to you, I give up my ownership, and then you take over that ownership forever. There's another kind of thing where I don't want to give up my ownership, but you take it away from me by conquest. That's a legal way of acquiring something. But just like it's legal for me to take away your ownership by conquest, it was legal for the Babylonians to take away our ownership by conquest.
God gave it to us. God said, well,
yeah, the same God also told the Babylonians to exile us.
In other words, we have no choice but to be exiled.
Right. And that was also God's will. So putting all that together...
Raise our claim, we have to be exiled?
Right. Putting that together, our claim was limited. The claim was only as long as we conquered the land and were fit to be here. Once God deemed that we should be exiled from the land, and he gave the Babylonians the right to conquer us, because that was all through prophecy, then their conquering superseded our conquering.
In order to make our claim better, we had to be exiled and come back and acquire it.
Basically, yeah. And the Pasuk says that.
Okay.
I'll do good for you, and I'll do better from your forefathers than what they did. Right? Now you'll be able to take it over in such a way that it'll be eternal.
It bothers me that we have to conquer the land that sort of have a claim. The Arabs have the same thing, that they want to conquer us.
Yeah, but that's only when our claim to the land was through conquering. That was the first time around. Once the land was given to us by the people who conquered it, or the people who inherited from the people who conquered it, the Persians, and they willingly gave us the rights to land. We then acquired it in a normal act of acquisition. That remains forever.
It was the borders of the land that gave us then, or the permanent borders that are...
Well, basically, yes and no. God gave us this land, right? And even though there were portions that at that time were not taken over, but basically that was part of the deal. And once we got back and we made an acquisition on most of the land, it helped for the rest too. So basically, whatever land we will take over throughout history within those borders is ours. No one else has a claim to it anymore. And if they take it from us, they're not taking it with God's consent. Because at that point on, God didn't give anybody permission to take it from us. He gave the Babylonians permission prophetically. But after that, no one had permission. So that's what marriage is. Any questions more on this? Okay, that's not something you can tell somebody on one foot. But you see that sometimes the claims against the Torah are because of ignorance. And if you really understand what's going on, there's no claim at all. Right? It's nothing, there's nothing, no problem. It's only that it looks on the surface problematic. If you delve into it, not only isn't it problematic, but it fits beautifully with what the Torah outlook on whatever the subject is.
Okay, the Drash Rabbah could be applied to other things where you have the same word, like kach?
Yeah, it's not something you can do arbitrarily. It's something that you have to have a Kabbalah from your Rebbe all the way back to Har Sinai, that these words were meant to learn something one from the other. It's one of the principles that God gave with the Torah. It's not an arbitrary thing. I can't say, well, this word is similar to this word, and therefore let's learn these two things. Right. Shmuel said that is a principle. But that principle is for sure something that you can't do on your own. You have to have a Kabbalah. You have to have a tradition from your Rebbe all the way back to Har Sinai, that when the Torah was given, these words were meant to be learned one from the other. It's part of the oral Torah. They say that they can figure out what the shekel, the kind of shekel that was talked about, right? How much of a volume of silver it was, and in today's market, it comes out to a few million dollars.